know about relationships, but you're wrong. Listen, there's no magic bullet. I'm teaching life skills.
When you're sick, you need medicine. It don't always taste good.
Nah.
But it'll get you better. You need this medicine.
Yeah.
It ain't gonna always taste good. But this is what you need. Men and women, bottom line, we need to have the conversation. Your partner wants to give up control, but only if you know how to drive. This is about being the best you could ever be. Whoever you are, I don't care if you're a man, a woman, LGBTQ, space aliens. I'll save anybody, I don't care. I'll teach a hedgehog how to have a threesome.
What do you mean by that?
Look, you don't have to listen to me, but you're wrong.
Listen, I know I'm great. And I know you're thinking, Dante, there's no way I could be like you. But you could be me, you know why?
Because you know who I was? Before I was me, I was you. You.
Man score 202.
Better hear what I've got to say because you won't get it again.
I'm not an alpha male. I'm not a beta male either. I'm just a better man. Better man.
Well, put your happiness first, because if you don't, they won't.
Yo, what's up, Square Pimpin' Gang? GYBB, get your balls back. WWDD, what would Dante do? The sexual revolution is being podcasted, and I am excited. This is a special show. Now, I know I've said that 500 times before, but this time I mean it, because we got a special guest. First and foremost, how's my boy Harry? What's going on, baby?
Oh, doing good, man. Running around like a lunatic, but doing good. We're getting the show. We're getting the show on the air.
Yeah, well, it ain't easy. It ain't always easy. You good? You ready to rock
and
roll?
Yeah, man, I'm ready to go. I'm having a tough time keeping these gators down, but other than that.
Difficult. I want to introduce my guest. You may have seen him on Colbert. Very, very funny dude. One of the dudes that I run into very often, running around doing spots all over the city. Give it up for Nick Griffin. Yo, give it up for Nick. What's going on,
yeah,
Nick?
Yeah, good to see you, Dante. Hi, Harry. Yeah, we've been seeing each other for years and years and years and just couldn't make it work, and I'm thrilled to be here.
Man, I appreciate you coming in. We've been trying to get you on for years now, so we finally got you. So,
well, I'm here. I'm excited, man.
It took a pandemic, but we got you.
A bunch of people had to die for this.
A lot of people had to die. Yeah. And we
but
like,
it was worth it. I think it was worth it.
I think it was worth it, too. But my fans would say that, too, that they it was worth it. How you been, bro? How you doing?
I've been kind of like everybody, man. I've been hustling, trying to get gigs and staying inside. And then, you know, lately I've been just, I've been a little bit of road stuff, but not much, you know?
Yeah. Where have you been going? You been going to crazy Florida, or you been going to places that are kind of, you know, reasonable?
Fairly normal. You know, I'm from Kansas. I know that's not impressive, but, I'm originally from Kansas, so I play the Midwest a lot. I was just in Ohio and St. Louis, and they're pretty lax, you know. They're not, you know, they think it's over.
Yeah. Yeah. How's that work when you're meet and greet at the end of the night?
I'm not sure how. It's okay. You know, I've kind of been pretty cavalier about meeting people and shaking hands and all that. I grew up with six brothers and sisters, so I haven't been scared of much since. And everything's been good. You know, I haven't had any problems. I never got the COVID. I got all the vaccinations and took care of that stuff. But yeah, I'm pretty okay with it.
Okay. All right. That's good. I would have really preferred to get you in the studio, but, you know, people are a little weird about being in the studio still here and there, and it's, you know, it's pretty closed. I mean, we get it, it's well ventilated, plus we have a full bar, which is always nice, but we've had a couple people come in, and some people are not with it, and so, you know, and I just figured it would be easier. I had such a rough time getting you on. I was like, if I get him on a Zoom call, we could do that, right? So that was my thinking.
You'd be surprised how many people are more willing to do a show if they can do it from their bedroom, turns out. That's what we learned.
I mean, that's what I really want to do comedy that way, right from my bedroom. But
you guys are right. Yeah, I mean, I take about two naps a day. So me leaving the house, it has to be a very special reason. It's a
special reason, right? It's got to be money involved. Exactly. Nick, are you, I mean, I met your girlfriend before. I don't know. Are you still with the same girl?
Yeah. Leslie, we've been together for, geez, almost 5 years. So, wow. We're doing well.
How'd that go with the COVID?
It was challenging. You know, we stayed in I was living in Hell's Kitchen, and she had a place over in Midtown East. And as you guys probably have read or heard, Hell's Kitchen went really bad after a while. So I moved in with her about a year and a half ago. And we were in a little studio apartment, and that was, it was fine, but it was a little tight.
Close.
We got a one bedroom now and everything's great. You know, I keep to my playroom and she's got her work.
right. It's interesting because you talk about I still have my day job from when I started doing comedy with the phone company.
Yeah.
So I work right in your area. Like I pull right out of 47th Street and 12th. And so that shit was like Mad Max. It was insane. The homeless people and the violence and the crime was in fucking sane. Like, I had a friend of mine who lived right on 51st, and he was like, look, when it first started, he was like, I don't let my wife go to the store after it gets dark. So it really got, was it really that bad for you as well?
Well, you're explaining it perfectly. It was like Escape from New York, you know?
That's exactly what I was thinking about.
After dark, it was very, very aggressive homeless and street people. There's a lot of junkies in my neighborhood, a lot of junkies. Yeah. And I've always had a hard time sleeping, and I would stay up. Some nights I would stay up all night, and like at 6, I'd go take a walk in the morning to get my exercise done for the day. And it was like everyone was heading back to their little hole, all these street people. And I know, mild assaults from people, from lots of friends who went through it. And it's just very aggressive now.
Yeah, it was insane. I mean, like 36th Street, 47th, 40, like all over 11th, like over by what you call it was insane, by 34th Street. I mean, I'm not a dude that really looks at neighborhoods and go, okay, this is a rough neighborhood. You know what I mean?
Right. I understand.
I kind of grew up in that. I mean, I grew up in Brooklyn in the 80s. So it's like, whatever, but it was scary. How was it?
I've seen movies about the 80s. All it was people breakdancing each other for territory.
it was a lot of breakdancing for territory.
It didn't look that rough. Everybody was wearing mesh and neon and jackets. Seemed cool to me.
Parachute pants and Webo boots. Absolutely. It was my thing. I still got my Webo boots. But I mean, it was fucking insane.
Down in the Port Authority, obviously, and down in Penn Station. I mean, it's just awful down there. Yeah, and it looks bad.
It's been really crazy. You've been with your girl like 5 years.
Five years.
I remember when you broke up with the other one. And I mean, because you can always tell where people are at because of their acts. You know what I mean?
Like, sure.
The act goes really dark at some time.
Yeah. And
then it kind of got bright. You kind of had a brighter outlook. It's insane how the litmus to our life is the material that we're talking about, you know?
Absolutely.
Conversely, Harry's been talking a lot about male rape, and I don't know what's going on with that.
Yeah. But you don't know what angle, which way it's coming from.
Yeah, I don't know if you are the raper
I'm against it. Yeah, okay.
That's a bold position.
I thought with the way comedy's going, somebody had to speak out and go against it.
You thought somebody, and that's I mean, that's what people say about you. You're bold, Harry. You are bold. You talk about the rough issues. But it's funny because I ended up getting married and I got a little kid now. And
oh, congratulations.
Yeah, that happened right before right before the pandemic. So it was a little, it was interesting, which was kind of cool because I got to spend a lot more time with him. I mean, just because I was home and it wasn't so much going on. But I mean, as soon as things that the cap popped and people started, did you do a lot of stuff on the roofs and open outdoor stuff, or did you kind of just wait till it came back?
No, I did a lot of that stuff. I did a lot of stand-up New York park shows and a lot of, as you know, tiny cupboard shows. And yeah, those were tough.
Dude, going up on that fucking fire escape.
So like, explain to people who don't know, the tiny cupboard is like a factory or some turned art gallery in New York, but they were doing shows on the roof of this factory. And the only way to get on the roof, it wasn't designed for people to go up there. You got to go up the fire escape on the side. And
it's
then,
not like when you think of a fire escape, you think of a, you know, a little thing you go up, and it's literally just a metal staircase strapped to the side of the building. Three flights up, and then you got that drain pipe that you gotta
shimmy around it.
If you want to stay close to the wall, you can't stay close. Then you get on the roof and the roof is tender and
has
soft.
Some give to
yes.
It.
Yeah. And that's one of my, issues is I don't like heights at all. And
really?
So that going up those steps was, you know, that was the shows were hard to begin with. And then you have to go up this maze to get in there. And, it's amazing what we did for comedy.
Here's how bad things got. That was a coveted gig.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Everybody
wanted to do the tiny cupboard. They were like, can I go up on a fire escape on a roof?
Please, can I go up? When?
With some Brooklyn hipsters, like, oh, I can't wait to do it. It's weird.
Everyone was 25 because you don't know adults going to go up that fire escape at 5 o'clock on a Tuesday.
I had a booking for it, and I was driving I said, let me go check it out. I went up. Checked it out, went up and sat up there, and then I canceled the gig. I go, there's no way I'm coming up to I'm not.
Yeah.
Like, it was that bad. Harry, you went up there, right?
Up there a couple times, and like I don't like heights either, so I'd rush up the thing or whatever.
Yeah, yeah,
and
I think that's best.
I try to do that, right? And it was easier at night, actually. This way you don't see the bottom. But then when you give up and you just walk, get up there and you walk around and the roof has some give to it, that was a little rough. You're like, I don't... It's not the way I want to go out. I don't want to die. Like,
here's a funny thing. Tale. It was so uncomfortable for me. I went up there and then I got comfortable once I was up there. And then I was like, I really don't want to walk back down that flight of stairs.
Right.
So then I stayed there for all the horrible comics. Cause it's like every horrible comic in the city was performing up there. And because they were all producing shows. And then I was like, I'm just going to sit here and watch horrible comedy for the rest
I will
of my
say,
life.
As you get older, you will move less, so you will sit through the comedians.
Oh, yeah.
Like, yesterday we were at the comic strip waiting to go on, and there were some, it was like a newer talent night or whatever before we went on. And my girl was like, how do you guys do this? I go, I think Dante's not going to get up because his back hurts. He's going to sit through this. Because by the time he gets up and goes to sit down at the other booth, then he's got to get up again.
I got to get back and come back again. And,
you're like,
so I just sat through it with a blank look on my face and just and I died a little inside. I died a little bit inside. It's just insane. How long you been doing it, Nate?
Oh, God, I hate to say it, like 32 years.
Really? So where'd you start?
When I started, you know, you talked about the 80s. I started about 88 in Kansas City. Comedy was like the new, I don't know, video arcades or something. They started popping up everywhere. And as
it was,
you know,
a big trend in the 80s. Like a big boom was the first big
boom
they called it. Yeah.
Every Italian restaurant had a mic in the back of the room. And obviously coffee shops and restaurants and bars. And so I was doing it. I started about 88, 89. And then I moved to New York in 91, 92. I only stayed for 3 years because I couldn't get any stage time. Mm-hmm. And I had a couple buddies move to LA and I followed them.
Okay.
And I was in LA, Dante.
Who were your buddies? Who's your buddies?
Well, there was one was a writer, but one was a guy named Steve Marmel, who ended up writing for he went out there to write for Arsenio Hall. So I followed him out to L.A. And I mean, basically, he said, you know, he was, you know, didn't know many people out in L.A. And we had kind of hung out together in New York. And I was complaining every week that I wasn't getting any spots, of course. The tiny cupboard hadn't been invented yet. And, so I followed him out there and I stayed out there for 13 years. I got married out there. I got divorced out there. And then I moved back to New York probably 12 years ago, 13 years ago.
Okay. That's when I met you. I met you around that about 12 years ago. Yeah.
When did you start?
I started in 2000. I've been doing it about 2021. Between about 21. So I started. So, but what's interesting is I don't know. I mean, I've talked about this 100 times, but I was a male stripper before.
I knew that.
Right. So I was a male stripper. And right around the time when you talk about the 90s, around that is when Def Jam broke. And
yes.
So I was promoting these male reviews and I always wanted to be a stand-up comic. Like I was one of those kids that would get up out of bed, sneak out of bed to watch
Carson,
whoever was on Carson for that night, anytime they had a comedian. And I mean, like, I remember watching, like, Emo Phillips and Gary Mule Deer.
Oh, funny.
Paula Poundstone. Sure. All the white guys that had their jacket rolled up.
Sure.
I was a fan of that. And so when the Def Jam thing broke, I used to book Tracy Morgan and Mike Epps and all of those guys to open for the strip shows. And I didn't think that anybody would take me serious because, like, I was really a kind of a big, I mean, as far as a male stripper can be, I was a pretty big male stripper on the East Coast. And I just didn't think anybody would take me seriously. So I just kept, like, I said, well, I'll just promote, right? Because, you know, you kind of, and I remember J.B. Smoove, I always tell the story about J.B. J.B. Smoove used to make me pee my pants. Like, I remember doing a gig with him, and it was in a big kind of loft banquet spot. And he starts talking about how he's going to fuck the crowd up because they're not laughing. And he takes a chair and he starts beating up this chair. Like he's climbing on the speakers. He's dropping elbows on I'll get you, mother. And he was like, you know, he's kind of, you got to watch what I want to say. He's like a comedy rapist, but I don't mean it. Like he just keeps hitting the punchline until you crack. And then you just lose your shit. And I remember him dropping the elbows. He was fucking this chair up for like 15 minutes. He just fucked this chair up. And it made me laugh. And I remember booking those guys. And I just wanted to do it. But I remember when you get a guy like that, you think, which is interesting because you're not a guy that people laugh at. Do you know what I mean? Not as a comic, but I'm saying as a person. You're not a guy, like, I'm not a guy that people like, I'm not a, like, when you think about J.B. Smoove, people laugh at J.B.
Smoove. Sure, Tracy Morgan.
Yeah, like, you're a guy who kind of people don't laugh at. And so I always was interested as how I would bridge that because I wasn't a goofy kind of, like, you're not a goofy guy. You know, I mean, we all do self-deprecating stuff, but it's not like, that's not like you're kind of like, this is my story. Do you know what I mean?
So what about what did your stand up look like when you first came out? You know, I mean, was it just like a Tonight Show set where you?
No, I did. So first thing I did, I was a man. So I went to college in at SUNY New Paltz and I was on a fencing scholarship. Right. And so I fenced foil since I was like 10 years old.
Yeah.
And the way I learned that was like, you didn't put a weapon in your hand for 6 months. Like all you did was advance. All you did was work footwork for 6 months. Then when they put a weapon in your hand, you didn't move. You just stood still and did that.
So I always had this kind of very methodic way of looking at any task. And so the first thing I did was I bought every book on comedy writing and stand up that there was. I don't even think there were that many at the time.
Maybe three or four. I mean, I was 10 years before you, but I did the same thing. Yeah.
But they're all written by Judy Carter, though.
And
real obscure joke.
But solid.
But solid. And so I understood technique really well. What you talk about, your boy, what was his last name? The one that you went out to LA with?
Oh, Steve Marmel.
So Larry Amoros wrote for. So Larry Amoros was teaching a class, and I took Larry Amoros's class.
Right, I remember Larry.
And Larry had gotten into trouble because of some sexual harassment that he was feeling everybody up at the Arsenio show. So, but I took his class, and then I just was like, I want my technical aspect of what I do to be perfect, because I didn't think people would laugh at me. So I said, if I lean on the fundamentals, I could do okay. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you kind of had an athletic background and applied that to.
Yeah, just very specific setup, punchline. I understood that stuff, and then I also understood because stripping is a lot like comedy. Like, you create this kind of persona, and then you market this persona, and then you hone it. You're constantly honing it and perfecting it, and how congruent it is how much people like it. You know, like, the more congruent it is with who you are, the more honest and truthful it is, the more people resonate with it. So, but I knew that people saw me as this big kind of scary dude. I was, you know, I was powerlifting at the time. Even when I met you, I was still powerlifting. I was like a brick shit house. And I knew that people would be intimidated me. So, you know, the funny is, if the truth is here, the funny is at either end of the truth. If you confirm what they already think about you, then they laugh. And if you go totally against what they think about you. So if I get on stage and I go, so I was just bagging up crack before I came here, that's funny. And if I go, oh, I was home making banana bread, that, you know, so I understood that. And so it was very formulaic. And I did this guy who was kind of this sociopath kind of guy who just got out of jail. And all of my jokes were that guy's jokes.
Right.
So my first joke was, I never had many friends, mostly just hostages. Right. And it was just like kind of very Stephen Wright, bang, 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 bang. But it worked because of the look, and I was killing, but I knew that I wanted to talk about more. And I knew that guy couldn't talk about more. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that guy.
That guy. So that guy doesn't allow itself. So anytime you do a character, it limits you to what you, because you always, I always look at it like Bart Simpson is 9 years old, but he's been 9 years old for 25 years. You know what I mean? Because he only matures one episode at a time. He only matures
right
as a 9 year old in the episode. And the same thing is true when you do a character. The only time that character is really present is when you get on stage. So they don't mature. Whereas you, as a human being, you've gone through divorce and all kinds of different things. And you can't really talk about it because the character is not living you. You're almost living a double life in a sense.
Right.
And so 4 years in, I stopped doing the character, scrapped all the material and started from scratch. And I was doing really well, but I just knew that there was going to be an end to it, you know, and that I wouldn't be able to express what I wanted to express. And so I started from scratch, started all over, scratched all the 4 years of jokes. I was killing. I was, you know, and then I just started again and started building it again. And then, you know, you find out that a lot of the things that you said that you thought you had to throw away, you didn't really have to throw away. Harry was saying that about, you know, like, Harry lost a shitload of weight. And he was like, this younger comic was saying, you know, I don't want to lose weight because I don't want to lose all my fat jokes. And he was like, you only lose 10% of it, really. Yeah. And
right.
Whatever you lose,
still solid. You can just reframe it and just go, I lost weight, and tell your story that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it's a good enough joke, you can reframe it.
So it's an interesting thing, because the journey for, the show that we do is mostly about relationships, and I'm always looking for the connection between that, the universal connection in everything. I believe that there are these universal truths. And when you understand, when you boil those universal truths down to the root, you have a little nugget of wisdom that you can reapply with everything else. Like, for instance, I always say that an audience is a lot like a woman, right? If you're needy and you're too anxious and you're too given, then the audience will reject you, because it's almost as if you're saying, I'm not worthy of your time.
Right.
You know, and whereas if and a young comic will get resistance from an audience, and then what's the first thing they do is try harder.
Sure.
Look for more, which is, that's the kiss of death. When they're not giving you anything and somebody go, you guys are a great crowd. The thing to do is to tell them that they're not a great crowd, and then right. It changes the power dynamic. And so I've learned these kind of things in comedy that I reapply in relationships and in life. And it just, it always kind of works up. Anytime that you're too thirsty or you're too needy, whatever you're dealing with, if it's in a relationship or whatever, they tend to, it's almost as if you're communicating that you have lesser value. And how do people know what your value is? You tell them. If you're not telling them directly, you're telling them in the way that you carry yourself and whatever the subtext is.
Yeah, I agree on all that. And I was like you early on. I think you have to be a couple of ways. You can come out dirty because you're just so desperate to get a laugh, you're going to say fuck and shit. Or you can do what we did, which was write these very, or I don't want to compare yourself to me.
No, it's fine. You can. You're a craftsman. You can do that.
Yeah, I wrote these very specific setup punchline, like right out of the book that Harry was talking about, Judy Carter book, 1, 2, 3, boom. And I did fine. They always let me go up on open mic that I'd get 3 minutes and I didn't have to fight for a spot. But it's like you said, it was very limiting. And also you get exposed to so many new comics over the years, you just get exposed to more comics and you see the what's possible, the possibilities right. in stand up.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. You bring up JB Smoove. He's one of those people. Like, I feel like I've worked with everybody or at least knew of everybody. And I was on the West Coast when JB Smoove was getting, but I never knew of JB Smoove before Curb. Isn't that crazy? Just didn't know anything about him.
He was a New York guy. He was from Jersey, but he did the Chitlin Circuit rooms for a long time.
Right. Like, that's what I learned.
Yeah. He did that. And then he just got so big with that. But Curb was really his expression of this kind of mainstream kind of thing that happened. Yeah, and then that's when he blew up, really. Like, he blew up mainstream.
Dante was talking before about seeing you, and he knew that you'd broken up with somebody just because the material had changed or the direction of what you were talking about. How intense does that affect your personal life and relationship stuff affect what you do? Like, is it instant? You go on stage and you're just automatically all right, I got to go in.
Yeah, I don't know. I have no poker face at all. So if I'm down, everybody knows it. And that happened a lot. Like I when I went through my divorce, which was many years ago, not a big deal, but I was so run over and everyone knew it. And for, I'd probably say for a good year, it looked bad on stage. Like it just like I my jokes were strong enough to get me through my set, but people can tell I was affected. And then I started to write really good divorce jokes. And, there was a lot of freedom in that. and a lot of empowerment in that. And I think that's kind of where I think that's where I turned the corner in my career, is just talking about my divorce and finding out, like I said to Dante, the possibilities of what I could do with stand up or whatever.
When did you say it turned the corner? Like did it really turn the corner when you came to New York, or was it kind of turning around?
Maybe a couple years before I got to New York. I mean, I always worked. I was just getting by. And I think you sound like you, I struggled for years just trying to get by. I just got by. And I mean, I never had to get a day job, but I was literally just getting by. And I've lived in a studio apartment for years and years and years. And then I got the divorce material out and I got on Letterman, and then I just got a little bit of, my price went up a little bit more in demand. And that's what happened. And then things started to pick up, but that was probably, 20 years into my career.
Really? So, I mean, okay. Cause it's a weird thing, because I had success in movies. But I really,
you did what was the fighting movie?
It's called Fighting. It was called Fighting. The movie with Channing Tatum. I did that. That was a big thing.
Yeah, and you were in the trailer and everything.
Yeah, and then I did I did a bunch of movies like that, but I also did Blacklist. I did like 8 episodes of Blacklist.
Oh, that's tremendous.
And then I did Power with 50 Cent's thing, Power, and I actually left Power because I got the opportunity to do Blacklist, and Blacklist was NBC mainstream. And so at the time, it's changed so
very
much.
Very popular show.
You had to, you always go mainstream first because it gives you the, but I mean, all of that is to shit now. Like, who the fuck knows what gets you more exposure or not. But it makes me feel good that, because I really haven't gotten the props, I think, comedy wise, in comedy. So it's when you said you've been doing it for 30 years, I feel for you because of the pain. But I also feel like, okay, so I could, it's, if you stick with it and you stay true to it, it happens, it happened to Mike Yard. I mean, Mike Yard was like 30 years old, 30 in before he did Larry Wilmore's show.
Yeah. The nightly show or whatever.
Yeah. And that was just him. Like, I'm doing comedy and I enjoy doing comedy. I love doing comedy. I want to be good at it. I make money at it, because he also started like with J.B. Smoove and those guys on the Chitlin Circus side. And so the difference with that was that you could always make a living on that side, because everything was pay up front. Like, if you did a spot, you made $100,
Right.
On a weekday, was different. But you didn't get those opportunities. You would never get the Letterman opportunities from that. So it was a weird kind of trade-off. And there's a lot of guys like J.B. Smoove who made a living. But what's interesting, I think what's interesting is that, a lot of times I'll have I also do consulting, and I do like where I consult guys about relationships and guys who, not particularly great in social dynamics and stuff. And I've gone through situations where I've listened to a lot of pickup stuff, and I used to teach pickup, but authentically, the thing that works best is just the honesty, the congruency of who you are and what you put out there. I find that women often see if there is some incongruency, that incongruency is perceived as deception. And that deception is what makes them feel unsafe. And then them feeling unsafe makes you unattractive. And it happens in a very quick way, And so one of the things that I do is, like, if a guy tells me, I'm not really good with girls. I'm 35 years old. I've been laid once in my life, whatever. And I would have them do. I have this thing where I tell them to lay the 5 bricks. It's where they go out and pay 5 compliments a day to 5 women a day. with no intention on getting anything in return.
Right.
You know, so there's nothing at stake. So it literally becomes like a social open mic that you're doing. It's because even with all the shitty, I mean, you've been doing it 30 years. So even the shittiest open mics, sometimes just getting on stage and telling your jokes out loud gets you to a closer place to where you want to be. And so these guys just paying a compliment, even with nothing in return, not looking for a number, not looking to get laid, just enough something non-sexual, like, wow, your makeup is impeccable, or
right,
or I love your shoes, or it just gets you to a place where you're social, you know, and it's almost like comedy. It's like you don't really get to the truth of what you want to say on stage until you've been on stage long enough that you don't have the anxiety of getting on stage. You know, do you still get nervous or no?
I don't think the word is nervous. I think I get excited. I mean, I'm a little, I mean, I don't think it's nerves. I think it's excited.
Yeah.
I think you're 100% right about the anxiety that you get to the point where you are okay with whatever will happen on stage. I think a lot of that comes from success and failure, like just bombing a lot and going up, in bad gigs and all that. I mean, a lot of it's just time.
Yeah.
I always lived and died every set for years and years and years, just be like, oh, I suck. Oh my God, I'm great. Oh, I suck. I'm great. And this is back and forth and back and forth. And now I just work at really trying to get better and more relaxed. I think that the key, you know, as I'm sure you've had young comics and obviously the people you consult with ask you certain questions. And my big answer when comics say, how do I get better, is just relax and do lots of sets. Cause I just don't think, I think experience and relaxing and, you know, you were talking about girls. I just think relaxing.
Yeah.
You just got to relax. It's just, and it's so hard.
Easy. Yeah. 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 I was going to say that it seems like such a simplistic thing. Just relax and just do it. But the point is, that you kind of have to have a way of approaching that, because so it's the way I liken it to, you know, there's this, genetically we still have the fight or flight impulse, and so whenever fear happens, we either want to run or we want to fight, but what instantly happens is that fear comes over your brain or comes over your body, and then you can't even access the information that you would normally have. Like, so you've been doing comedy 30 years, but the minute you have fear, you limit your ability, you limit the knowledge and your ability and your skill because of the fear, because you can't access the full file cabinet of all the things that you've learned in the course of that 30 years. And that happens with the fear based on the fight or flight principle. You have to get past the fight or flight principle, and the only way you can do it really is the way a boxer, like if you're not a dude that fights and you're in an altercation and you get you're worried about getting punched in the face, a boxer gets in the ring knowing he's going to get punched in the face. It becomes part of that's just what boxing. Nobody boxes and doesn't get punched. The best boxers get punched in the face. Right. And so going in with the mentality of that this is going to get greasy, it may or it may not. And then if it does, it does. And like you said, just being okay with it. And so a lot of times when the guys will lay laying the five bricks or paying those five, first thing I do is I make them promise me that they'll do it. I go, what you have to understand is your truthfulness sharpens other people's honesty. So the more truthful you are, the more forced people around you are to be honest. And if they're not, then they're exposed. And if they're dishonest, what you'll find is a lot of times they won't even fuck with you. Like, dishonest people, they want to get away from me, because those people, they don't want to be exposed. And when they feel your honesty,
they like, oh, I don't want, let me go tell my lies someplace else where somebody will accept them, where everything is in that gray area. And so the first thing I always emphasize is authenticity and truth, is to tell the truth and to keep your word and be credible. And I go, look, if you're asking me for help with this, I need a commitment of you to do this. If you say you're going to do this, I'm expecting you to do this, the honor system. And what happens is after the first week, I mean, it's five a day every day. So it's 35 women a week. I mean, I know pimps that don't talk to women that much, you know. So it becomes kind of this mundane kind of practice, kind of like when you're young and you get on open mic, and the open mics are shitty and the people are leaving and there's two people and six beer bottles. And you build this callus. And then when you're not looking for something in return, when you're simply doing the road work or hitting the heavy bag like you would do as a boxer, it becomes, now you get to access all of your brain in the context of this kind of social dynamics. And I think the same is true in relationships. You know, I think you have that anxiety. We get that anxiety when we feel like we're in a relationship that we don't really deserve to be in. Do you know?
Yeah, I also think that much like comedy, relationships, I guess both, ego is a big thing. And if you start worrying about, I can't have my ego bruised and I don't want an audience member to make me look bad. All that stuff is just obstacles that get in your way. Yeah, you know, you can't have this kind of bravado that I'm not going to take, that it's like you said, that I'm never going to get hit. You're going to get hit in stand up. Yeah. And you're going to look bad at times, and it's not going to go perfectly. You're not going to say the right thing every single time. But at the end of the day, I think if you relax, calm down, and that to me is a huge deal. And I think you're right with I think everything is repetition. You get better. Like, it's just punching, hitting a heavy bag, you know, whatever, throwing a football, reading books. Doing stand up, talking to girls. The more you do it, the more confidence you're going to build. Right. And
And then more you have, when you have the confidence, you remove the fear, and then you get the chance to, like, I mean, if you think about, you said 32 years you've been doing it, right?
Yeah.
So think about all that you've learned in 32 years that you've seen everything. Like, there's nothing. Pretty much, you would be hard pressed to go, I never seen that before.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so in that calmness, you have access to 32 years of experience, minutes on stage. And so when you literally have got the whole comedy Bible in your, I mean, there's another book, but you have that, you have the whole Bible in your head that you can just access if you stay calm enough to access it. And the minute you, like you said, your ego goes, oh, how dare you? Or, do you not know how, you know, your ego wants to go, do you not know who I am? And then once you're there, it's you're lost.
Yeah. Yeah, the funny thing is, it's like you said, once you get to the place where you say, you know, don't you know who I am, which you think would be an aggressive position, is actually you're on your heels at that point. Yeah, you're not in a power position at that point.
Because nobody says that.
No.
If you get a 3-year-old and he goes, I'm going to punch you in the mouth, you go, oh, okay. But whatever. It's just, right. You don't even respond to that. Whereas if it is, it's who you know who the fuck I, yeah, we get it. You don't know who you are. You're trying to convince yourself and me in the same context. It's a really weird dynamic that the things that are not said are almost more important than the things that people say, you know?
Yeah. I, as far as girls go, like, I just, for a big thing for me in terms of if there was a turning point was like getting older. Like, I think early on when, you know, you're obviously, if girls are your thing, you're so and I'm sure this is true of guys, your thing, you're so excited about being with that person that you lose your mind. The first, you know what, you know, you're giggling when you're 13, 14, 15. And it wasn't until I got a little older where I could calm down and go, well, look, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And I'm not, I don't have, you know.
But I think you also understand, I find this about comics a lot of times, it's comics tend to be insecure and they don't really understand how dope they are. Like even shitty comics, like, I mean, you got a pretty dope life. Like you stand up in front of people, people listen to everything that you have, that you do. Not only that, but you're literally, if you think about the insanity of putting yourself under scrutiny, because the minute they go, ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Nick Griffin, you walk on stage, you're being judged from the moment you stand on stage.
Right. And, absolutely. And
the insanity of us signing up for that every fucking day, 2, 3, 4 times a night sometimes, that we will be judged in that way, and and riding this kind of living, breathing tornado that can change and throw you at any given time, and being willing to live with that. And so very rarely is it many other professions where that's the case, where you're literally being judged moment to moment. And but then they'll get, you know, because it's something that they're unfamiliar with, where, you know, how many times, Harry, have we had comics on here and they'll go, yeah, I was talking to this girl, she was way out of my league.
Yeah,
and
all the time.
I'm like, no, she wasn't. She wasn't smart. She wasn't interesting. She wasn't funny. She didn't have great stories. You're paying the bill.
She's way out
you're picking up the Uber. You're like, the whole relationship is good because you have created all the aesthetics that make it good. Right. If you think about how often are you on a date or where the person that you, the square, you know, somebody who's not a comic is contributing to the social dynamic of the conversation or what's happening in a real way where they're actually contributing. We hang out with, you know, with some of the smartest and the most creative and intelligent people ever that's constantly are taking things and twisting it in different. And then when you get somebody who, you know, it's not even trained to think that way. I say this all the time. Bookers, you remember Candy, right? They used to book stand-up.
Yeah, of course.
So I used to always say to Candy, we love Candy's a fan of the show. Like, we broke Candy because Candy used to just hang out with comics. And then when she would date regular square dudes, she'd be like, ugh,
this is trash,
this is horrible. Like, right. I mean, on any given day, I mean, we've been at the Cellar any given day. It could be 3 comics who you don't even know, or not that you know, but you don't particularly hang out with. And you can have this moment where it's the greatest moment ever.
Right.
Some conversation or something that we're laughing at, something we're discussing. And then we all go home and do it again tomorrow.
Right.
With another 3 guys, you know, just people who you would never even have the conversation with. You know what I mean?
It's a
really extraordinary thing. But you get guys who are doing that every day and don't even put it in perspective to people that they're dealing with or relationship, that you're really the light in the relationship more so than not. You're funny. You're intelligent. Gotcha. It's and they take that for granted. Like I always did, with Norton, just, it's always amazing to me how he doesn't think himself worthy of, you know, certain women. And then, dude, you're so creative. Like you know, I don't like, what do you think that disconnect is?
I don't know. I think so much of what I believe is chemistry. I just sometimes believe your body doesn't allow you to think certain things. And I certainly have been down that road, but I agree 100% with what you do. And I think to add on to what you said about, I don't deserve this person or they're better than me. I think that other person that you're talking about would say, this guy's insightful. This guy's got a cool story. They're on your side.
Yeah, yeah.
Or at least that's what they're thinking. Maybe they're not showing their hand.
Right, right.
But they're thinking that. I agree 100%. I mean, I can't. I think one of the true blessings of being a stand-up is hanging out with funny, irreverent, like you said, great stories, insightful, the complete swath of humanity, the different, you know, races and creeds and colors and everything and talking about it and all that stuff. So yeah, you're just, you get a treasure trove of gifts from it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so, and then when you're dealing with, I got 27 years at the phone company.
Yeah.
With probably some of the dumbest guys, they were all worth $150,000, $200,000 a piece. They got a boat and a house and just dumb, just horrible. Just like what I remember, there was always this running joke because doing comedy. I mean, I did what was the bare minimum, and then I kind of kept really low. Like I wasn't available for everyone. Like, you wouldn't see me often.
Right.
And I wouldn't go to the events and the Christmas parties. And then I would show up and they would go, hey, get a load of the new guy. You know how many times I've heard that joke in 27 years? If I didn't hear that joke 180 times, I didn't hear it once. The same joke, never gets a laugh. Guys say it over and over. And I remember this guy saying, I go, let me ask you something. Has that ever got a laugh? I'm just curious because I've been hearing it for 25 years.
Yeah.
And you're so unaware that you just do it anyway. Right. And you're laughing at it as if it's such, you suck as a human being. Like, have the ability to be aware. Nick, can you hang out a little bit? We're going to close it down and then do a little few minutes for the Patreon behind the scene. Can you hang out for a few?
Sure.
All right. Plug anything you want to plug, please.
I have a little podcast I do with my friend Lori Palmateri. It's called Scary Monsters. You can get it on iTunes. It's just we watch one horror movie a week and talk about it. And other than that, just follow me on Instagram at, I think it's Comic Nick Griffin.
Okay, I appreciate it. Harry, talk to me.
You can just go to all my stuff at Harry Turjanian on my social media.
Everything, Google me, bitch. Dante Nero, everything's there. GYBB, get your balls back. WWDD, what would Dante do? The sexual revolution is being podcasted. Yo, I love y'all. Thanks for listening. Don't forget, if you like what we do, please sign up for the Patreon. It's manschool202. It's patreon.com/manschool202. Sorry. And sign up and you get the stuff that we're going to do behind the scenes, get a little deeper in and everything. I love y'all, man. Get at us.